Welcome back, everyone. It is the Damage Report. I'm John Adderall, and we've got a gigantic show for you. So the biggest chunk of the show today is going to be about the NRA. A couple of days ago, thanks to an undercover investigation, found out quite a bit about the NRA's strategy for dealing with the media aftermath of mass shootings, something that is becoming more and more common of a problem for them. And now we have not only that, which we're going to talk about, but also a sort of case study. How did one NRA official respond to the Parkland shooting last year? Who did they coordinate their messaging with? It is an amazing, disgusting story that we'll be breaking down about halfway through the show. We've also got some strike back against the DCCC's plan to blacklist companies that work with primary challengers in Democratic primaries. Ro Khanna, a friend of the show, responding very forcefully against that proposed rules change. And we've also got two awesome guests. So a little bit later on the show, you know, the whole education scandal, how theoretically some very wealthy people might end up going to jail over this. Well, Justin Papperny is an author and federal prison consultant. He's going to be joining the show. He's been working with some of those people to get them ready for possibly spending quite a while in jail, which is a very interesting job for a consultant to do. So we're going to learn what you should do if you're going to be spending the rest of your life in prison. That'll be interesting. I don't personally think I can make it a day, but maybe he can get me through a week or so. And a little bit earlier on the show, Sarah Kendzior is author and host of the podcast Gaslit Nation. She's going to be joining us on the show once again to break down, in this case, the Barr summary of the Mueller report and what we might expect to come from the full report just a little bit later on. But we're going to start off with a topic we talk about every once in a while on the show. This week is going to be bookended by the worst sort of offensive stupidity on climate change imaginable. Earlier this week, we were talking about how during a debate on the Green New Deal, Republicans wasted your time by talking about how the solution to rising global average temperatures is for you to have more kids and showing you pictures from Star Wars, which in any other context I would be totally in for, but this time it was a waste. And we've got something from Trump, too. One of the stupidest things I've heard about climate change in quite some time. That'll be in just a few minutes. Before we get there, though, let's put in the middle of this stupid sandwich, let's put some intelligence, someone who understands this problem. I want to show you a little bit more of AOC's remarks on the Green New Deal, specifically focusing on the costs of climate change. And when she's done, I'm going to show you some of those costs and how dire it actually is. So first, AOC.
You know, we talk about cost. We're going to pay for this whether we pass a Green New Deal or not. Because as towns and cities go underwater, as wildfires ravage our communities, we are going to pay. And we're either going to decide if we're going to pay to react or if we're going to pay to be proactive. And what we know is that prevention, you know, when you spend less money on prevention, you can prevent a lot of that damage from happening in the first place. So it's not a question of whether we're going to spend the money, because I'm very sad to say that the government knew that climate change was real starting as far back as 1989 when NASA was reporting this. And the private sector knew way back in the 1970s. So we had until around the time I was born to address this issue. I wish it didn't have to cost so much, but I'm going to turn 30 this year, and for the entire 30 years of my lifetime, we did not make substantial investments to prepare our entire country for what we knew was coming. So now it's coming all up at the end. It's like when we live our whole lives, and we don't eat healthily, and we don't move, and we pursue unhealthy activities. And then at the end of our lives, our healthcare costs are very high. We have the choice to lower the cost now. Because I can tell you the cost of pursuing a Green New Deal will be far less than the cost of not passing it. And with respect to our brothers and sisters and neighbors that are in agriculture, bring them to the table. Let's hold hearings. Let's add provisions. Let's amend the legislation to accommodate for the just transition and for the encouragement of those industries to grow. And I would also encourage to my colleague on the other side of the aisle that thinks we're trying to ban cows to actually read the resolution and understand that there's nothing to that effect in the legislation. And not only that, but we're trying to invest in these communities and our agricultural workers so that they can enjoy prosperity into the next century.
That was an impressive performance, considering that she doesn't know anything about the issues, we're told, or that she's just an actress. Apparently, one is really good at remembering long monologues because there was no teleprompter there. It certainly seemed authentic, but there are some who still look at all that and say, no, she doesn't actually know what's going on. Okay. Well, I think that she was spot on. I think that focusing on the inevitability of not just the damage, but the attendant cost to that damage is very necessary. I know that some people will see it as a scare tactic. It's not. It's 100% accurate. It is a warning against not just what's inevitably going to happen, but what we're already seeing. That's one of the things we've been focusing here on the damage report, is that this is not some problem that, you know, hypothetically, our grandkids, man, they're really going to be wrecked over this. No, we're getting wrecked over this. We are already getting wrecked financially every single year. And so there's a lot that I want to talk about, but I do want to talk about costs, because she talked about the costs that are going to come. Not the cost of the Green New Deal, the costs of the lack of a Green New Deal. So I went through a bunch of different places, studies that are estimates of things that will eventually happen, estimates of costs that we've already endured. And I just plucked random ones, because the thing is, there's so many, we could do the full hour. I could just read you horrifying statistics, and often I do. But I don't want to waste the whole show on that. Here's a random thing. And I'm focusing specifically on things that you probably don't even think about as costs of climate change. Reduced crop yields due to drought cost $56 billion between 2012 and 2017. We still had the crops. They're not totally wiped out yet. That will come at some point in a few decades. But now, just the reduced yields due to drought, $56 billion. That's almost a year of free public college for anybody who wants it in America. That was in reduced crop yields. These are the costs that we don't even see. We can sort of understand a hurricane. We get a wildfire. But those sorts of costs, we don't necessarily understand. But let's talk about the ones that are a little bit more obvious. So this is not in 50 years. This is next year. This was 2 years ago. Three storms that made landfall during the 2017 Atlantic hurricane season together cost the United States at least $265 billion. Not according to some crazy lib think tank. No, this is the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. That was $265 billion. None of those hurricanes were caused by climate change, but they were made worse by it, and they are going to be more common because of it. And that was one season, three hurricanes from one season, $265 billion. I don't know what the names of the hurricanes next year and 10 years will be, but I do know that the price tag is going to always be getting higher. Let's talk about some other ones. According to data provided by NOAA, the number of extreme weather events causing at least $1 billion in economic losses has increased more than 400% since the 1980s. And one of the reasons that I want to focus on that is that whenever we talk about the costs associated with extreme weather events, people say, hey, there's been fires. There was a hurricane before. Yes. And we can look at these things and we can say whether they're doing more damage and we can say whether they're becoming more common. That is what the scientific method is all about. There's a great article on it on Wikipedia. I would advise that anyone who doesn't understand the concept, look it up. You can learn a lot, actually. Some people make jobs and careers around it. But let's talk about the end of the century. We've got the costs that we've already dealt with. We've got the costs we're going to deal with in the near future. How big could it become? Because people want to scare you off with these cost estimates of the Green New Deal. Now, they are right-wing fever dreams. That's all they are. But it will be expensive. Saving a civilization probably should be. But what's the cost of not doing anything? So if we continue business as usual, no big changes that we deal with climate change, by the end of the century, heat-related deaths alone will cost $141 billion every single year. And by the way, that's by the end of the century. It doesn't become 141 after being zero the year before. We will be paying more and more every single year until eventually we're paying enough to insure health insurance just in the cost related to people who are dying due to the heat. Let's see. Again, business as usual. Well, coastal property losses will cost $118 billion. Not overall, not over the course of a century, but over the course of every single year from then on out. Heat-related lost wages due to heat waves, that'll cost $155 billion. That's one of those awesome hidden costs that people won't necessarily see in the headlines, but is going to cost our economy so, so much money. And when these estimates come out, and when people see them, people in power, how do they react? Some react like AOC, responsibly, I would say, with the urgency necessary to address this issue. But some who have far more power, like Donald Trump, when told about these estimates in November 26th, 2018, he said, I don't believe it. And I looked it up, and he's not a climate scientist. He doesn't have any sort of science-related education. But he doesn't believe it. Because he doesn't care. He's going to have died long before then. Would kids still be around at that point? I don't know. But our civilization hopefully will still be around. It will still be dealing with these costs that are not going to go away because we talk about cows being banned or we show pictures of tauntauns. It's a serious issue. It's a serious issue that requires a serious response. And there are a few people in Congress willing to address it with the seriousness it deserves. I hope to God that they get reinforcements in the next few elections because we're not going to get it. Not with the Mike Lees and the Donald Trumps. Donald Trump said in an interview with Sean Hannity last night, he said one of the reasons it's great he became president is because if he wasn't president, we'd be powered by the wind now. We'd be using wind power. And that would be sad because the wind only blows sometimes, unlike Trump, who sucks all the time. These are the sorts of idiot know-nothings who are running not just our climate policy, but all aspects of our government at this point. And that is why I place so much of AOC's quotes, because sometimes it is the only thing that is keeping me going, considering the threats that we face, the challenges that we face, and how ill-equipped or uninterested so many people in elected office are to actually do something about it. We're going to take a short break here. We're going to try to mix things up. Might still be a little bit depressing, but we've got Sarah Kendzior joining us. We're going to be talking about the Mueller report after this.
We need to talk about a relatively new show called the Republic, or UNFTR. As a Young Turks fan, you already know that the government, the media, and corporations are constantly peddling lies that serve the interests of the rich and powerful. But now there's a podcast dedicated to unraveling those lies, debunking the conventional wisdom. In each episode of the Republic, or UNFTR, the host delves into a different historical episode or topic that's generally misunderstood or purposely obfuscated by the so-called powers that be, featuring in-depth research, razor-sharp commentary, and just the right amount of vulgarity. The UNFTR podcast takes a sledgehammer to what you thought you knew about some of the nation's most sacred historical cows. But don't just take my word for it. The New York Times described UNFTR as consistently compelling and educational, aiming to challenge conventional wisdom and upend the historical narratives that were taught in school. For as the great philosopher Yoda once put it,
"You must unlearn what you have learned."
And that's true whether you're in Jedi training or you're uprooting and exposing all the propaganda and disinformation you've been fed over the course of your lifetime. So search for UNFDR in your podcast app today and get ready to get informed, angered, and entertained all at the same time.
Joining us to break down the William Barr summary of the Mueller report and all of the issues rippling off of that, Sarah Kendzior, author of The View from Flyover Country, Dispatches from the Forgotten America, and host of Gaslit Nation. Sarah, welcome back to the show.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Great to have you here. We originally wanted to have you on to talk about impeachment, and then some news developed over the weekend, and it seems like we should probably touch on it a little bit. So I've been following your activity concerning this over the week, but for those who might not have seen, what was your initial reaction to the Barr summary of the Mueller report?
It was exactly what I expected, and I'm glad that you're referring to it as the Barr summary of the Mueller report instead of the Mueller report. I had expected from the start that Barr would suppress whatever information Mueller brought forward that would be inflammatory for the Trump administration. That's, in fact, why he was hired. And, of course, Barr is someone with a long history of doing this. He was hired, he was essential in pardoning Republicans during Iran-Contra in the early 90s. He had written a memo condemning the Mueller report. Beforehand, that essentially functioned as an audition for the attorney general job. He had made his feelings clear, and so I thought that regardless what had happened, with the probe, that was Barr's purpose in being there.
So, I am trying to be very even in saying it might turn out that the 300 plus pages of the Mueller report, the actual report of which we've seen about 98 words so far, might end up shockingly confirming everything that Barr has said. But as of right now, we only really have his opinion. I don't find much of what he said to be particularly surprising. Do you think that there is reason to believe that if we get access to the full report, because despite the fact that Trump is saying it's perfect, total exoneration. They're doing everything they can to stop us from actually seeing it, and they might well redact significant portions of it. Do you think that there's reason to believe that it might not end up sort of, I guess, buttressing what Barr's interpretation of it was?
I mean, Barr put quite a lot of interpretation into those four pages. He only used 64 words from the actual Mueller report in terms of direct quotes. Among those was a quote saying that Trump was not exonerated, you know, in contrast to what Trump himself is saying. That said, I've had issues with how Mueller has done this probe. He didn't interview key parties, including Trump himself. He's made plea deals with individuals like Flynn in return for essentially nothing. That have made me question his judgment. We've seen an enormous amount of criminality play out in plain sight over the time of the Trump administration. We saw it beforehand during the campaign. We saw these illicit ties. We saw Trump ask Russia to hack Hillary's emails. You know, they were not subtle about this. And so in order to deny that there is illicit activity between the Trump campaign and Russian oligarchs, mafiosos, Barr tries to frame this as the Russian government, I think, to limit the scope. You really have to deny reality. You know, do I think that Barr will deny reality? Absolutely. Do I think Mueller will? Not as much. He's already indicted a lot of people who are implicated in this probe, including Manafort, Cohen, Gates pled, Flynn pled. Like, the evidence is right in front of us. That all said, I certainly think whatever comes forward, if anything comes forward in the Mueller report, will be far more damning than what Barr wrote. But it may not be the justice that we need as a country, to make any progress during this crisis.
If we do end up getting the full report, and if it turns out that there's at least something that Barr was not reflective of in his summary, it'll come in weeks, possibly a month or longer. And we've already had multiple news cycles of people who have not read a single word, not in the Barr summary of the Mueller report, who are now saying, because it doesn't show that there was collusion, there was nothing the whole time. We learned nothing. 700 days of investigation, there was nothing there, which to me seems like that must come as great news to Manafort and Cohen and all of those. I wonder about the damage that will be done to our long-term interpretations of this entire cycle of history based on how quick people are to try to take Barr's summary and say, because this confirms what I've been saying, we don't need to actually see it. And the storyline might have already been established at that point. Are you worried about that too?
I'm worried to some extent about the lying going on, about this false narrative that the Barr report is a trustworthy exoneration of Trump, prompting people to have to deny their own eyes and ears and reality in a very Orwellian kind of way. The same people who are doing that are the ones who missed the boat the first time around. They're the ones who didn't report on Trump's long history of corruption and criminality and ties to the mafia, not just Russia, transnational mafia ties, New York City, illicit financial dealings. This has been going on for his entire life. They also did not thoroughly investigate his ties to Russia. When the truth came out, when it became clear what was going on, those reporters looked incredibly foolish. And so, of course, they're trying to vindicate their own bad work by saying that there was never anything there all along and that everything we've seen over the last 2 years was just somehow a product of our imagination. But I'm less worried about narrative than I am about national security and public safety. This is an administration that is committing extreme crimes against human rights. It's a kleptocracy. It's partners with autocrats around the world, Putin in particular, but also, today we're getting news that Trump is making deals to give nuclear material, to sell nuclear material to Saudi Arabia. The sort of thing that Flynn was trying to do under the radar, that Kushner was trying to do under the radar, and illegally. Now they're just being upfront with it. This is very dangerous. The people who the Trump administration is partnering with are the worst people in the world. It's dictators. It's the mafia. It's hardened criminals who have no interest in the public well-being of the United States, and neither does Trump or his administration. And so in my mind, indictments were always more important than the Mueller report, because we kind of know what's in that report because we've been watching it with our own eyes. What we need are for vulnerable Americans, which basically includes everyone, but a very narrow elite at this point, to be protected from this administration.
Well, this administration certainly wants to go after some of the people, perhaps, that you've been talking about there. They're interested in indictments, too. So my last question for you is the response coming out of the Barr summary. You've got Trump sending a letter to TV producers asking for them to blacklist a number of different people. You have calls for investigations into Democratic elected representatives. They want new investigations against Hillary Clinton. They seem quite emboldened to go after their political opponents after this report has come out, which I'm sure probably does not come as much of a surprise to you.
No, it's not a surprise at all. And they would have done this no matter what the Barr report had said or the Mueller report. The reality TV president wants his show trials. They've floated this idea in the past, of basically prosecuting anybody who brought to public attention the illicit and illegal dealings that they have been making, with Russians and with other bad actors around the world. And of course, they want this story suppressed. They want to keep that money flowing. It's not that complicated. What is incredibly troubling is that they're doing it brazenly, that the media is not treating them like an aspiring autocracy, which is what they are. They're rolling over. They're accepting a false narrative. They need to stand up. They need to stand up for the truth, and they need to stand up, for members of their profession and not accept this, brutal witch hunt, actual witch hunt mentality, that Trump is trying to mainstream.
Well, we will see. It seems like a lot of the media is, they're so gun shy. Anytime the right starts to attack them, they start to shoot each other. They shoot themselves. We'll see if it ends up working out.
With the smoking gun. I mean, that's what's going on. They are loading the smoking gun that they say they can't find. So, yeah.
That's a great way of putting it. Sarah, thank you for joining us once again. We really appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
We're going to take a short break. When we come back, we're going to be talking about some other smoking guns having to do with the NRA and their media strategy in the immediate aftermath of mass shootings. We're going to be breaking down their general strategy and a case study after this. So in the wake of a mass shooting, one of the things that we pay attention to is how organizations like the NRA, those who push for ever-increasing gun rights, react to this, especially when the person had weapons they never should have had and uses that to kill multiple people. And usually the way it works is the NRA goes dark, the social media manager takes 3 or 4 days off, and maybe they have Dana Loesch make a video or something, and we laugh about it because it's ridiculous. And it seems like sort of an ad hoc thing, that they are just responding in real time to the events that are happening. But it turns out it's not actually that way. They do have a strategy, and it is not just meant to be applied here in the U.S. So thankfully, Al Jazeera conducted an undercover investigation for quite some time where they had an undercover reporter embed and film meetings happening between representatives of the NRA and an Australian party that wants to push for more gun rights. And so I want to delve into the advice that the NRA gave to this party so that they could seek to dismantle Australia's fairly rigorous gun control laws. So first, the party. Australia's One Nation Party, led by Senator Pauline Hanson, has long sought to relax the country's gun laws, which ban almost all automatic and semi-automatic rifles and shotguns. The rules, some of the toughest in the world, were introduced back in 1996 after a gunman with a semi-automatic rifle killed 35 people in the town of Port Arthur. Since then, Australia has had no mass shootings where the attackers did not know their victims. However, the NRA has denounced Australia's laws as, quote, not the definition of common sense. So why do they say that? They say that because they don't want those laws applied here inside of the U.S., and they certainly don't want that case to be used in pushing for gun control laws here in the U.S. So you had there, they had a mass shooting, they got rid of the guns, the shootings became far less common. Seems like something that could be applied to other places, and in other places that have much more stringent gun control laws, you do see far fewer massacres of the sort that we've become incredibly normalized to in the U.S. So, what is their strategy? They had these meetings, there are tapes that exist right now, you can actually go see them. There's a 48-minute one that is fascinating. So some of the takeaways. First, say nothing. If media queries persist, go on the offense, offense, offense. Smear gun control groups. Shame them with statements such as, quote, how dare you stand on the graves of those children to put forward your political agenda? Now that objectively is terrible, but understand that they're saying this is what you should do in the immediate aftermath of a massacre. You should say, how dare those people try to limit guns, a political agenda, in the wake of the shootings. That's what you should do to push for more guns. So they are, it's 100% projection. They want to use the opportunity as much as anyone. They just want it to be easier to get access to the exact sorts of guns that were used in these shootings. Furthermore, quote, just shame them to the whole idea. If your policy isn't good enough to stand on itself, how dare you use these deaths to push that forward? How dare you stand on the graves of those children? And so this is the individual, Lars Dalseid, NRA Public Relations. Obviously very skilled at public relations. Might have caused a bit of a PR problem for the NRA when the tapes got out, though. But goes on to say, you have somebody who leans to your side that worked at a newspaper. Maybe he was covering a city hall or was a crime reporter. We want to print up stories about people who were robbed, had their home invaded, were beaten, or whatever it might be. And that could have been helped had they had a gun. And that's going to be the angle on your stories. That's what he's got to write. He's got to put out 2 to 5 of those a week. Now, imagine that. That, of course, if you actually were to pursue that strategy, people would have no idea that there was this sort of coordination between local crime reporters and the NRA. It could be taking place anywhere in the U.S. or in Australia. It could be taking place in your local newspaper. And it could seem like, man, there's just one guy that really thinks people need to arm themselves, but he could actually be taking marching orders from the PR team at the NRA. 2 to 5 stories a week. Taking any case of violence and implying if the people had just had guns, it would have turned out better. That is their actual strategy. Now, going forward, let's see. We have sort of another example of this. We pitch guest columns in the local papers. A lot of the times, we'll write them for like a local sheriff in Wisconsin or whatever. And he'll draft it or she will help us draft it. We'll do a lot of the legwork because these people are busy. And this is our job. So we'll help them and they'll submit it with their name on it so that it looks organic. You know that it's coming from that community, but we will have a role behind the scenes. So that's Catherine Mortensen, again, NRA Public Relations. Because she didn't know at the time that she was being recorded, she's willing to be very honest and open about it. They are making up these things, giving them to sheriffs or whoever, wherever, to make it look organic. And then think about the things that you hear elected officials say in D.C. It might sound like, man, this politician just really likes hunting. Man, this person's got it in for deer. But how do you know that that speech actually had anything to do with the person who's delivering it and not everything to do with the NRA handing it to them? Doing a lot of the legwork for them because, you know, they're busy or whatever. And that is how, across the country, you have what is still relatively a small organization. The NRA gives money, but they're not one of the biggest lobbies, but they sure seem very popular. They seem damn near unassailable. And perhaps that's because they have a very good PR team going around the country and making it seem like more people support their agenda than actually do. And specifically trying to get that done in the wake of mass shootings when people are finally shaken out of their stupor and might do something about the violence that plagues us so commonly. Now, in this case, of course, it's made even worse because it's not just that they're trying to continue that cycle of violence here in the U.S., but they're trying to export it to Australia to get the massacres happening again in that country, a country that actually did do something about gun violence and has saved countless lives since then. Not if the NRA has their way. Now, let's talk about a specific example of this. Parkland shooting was obviously a terrible tragedy by itself, but also as an indication of how common this sort of violence has become. Shootings in schools specifically are not very rare in the U.S. anymore, but there was a silver lining coming out of that terrible shooting, the deaths of so many, a movement arose and was very successful inside of Florida and around the country in pushing for gun control legislation, causing a public opinion of the NRA to drop. Their donations have dropped as well. There's been some big movements as a result of that. But in the immediate aftermath of the shooting, the NRA was trying to get the public moving in a different direction. We have an official at the NRA who corresponded with a Sandy Hook conspiracy theorist to try to spread doubt and muddy the waters around that shooting. So we're talking here about the day after an email sent. This is by NRA officer Mark Richardson, who said, just like Sandy Hook, there's so much more to this story. The email was sent from his official NRA email address, by the way, and it was sent to a conspiracy theorist known as Wolfgang Halbig. He said to him, I want to read a bit more from the email. He said, how is it that Cruz was able to gain access to a secured facility while in possession of a rifle, multiple magazines, smoke grenades, and a gas mask? To pull the fire alarm, he had to already be inside, correct? When my children were in school, the only way into the school was through the front door and past the main office. We've been told that he was prohibited from entering the building with a backpack. Sorry, his grammar is horrendous. He was not alone. Just a few questions that have surfaced in the past 24 hours. Thank you for all the information and for what you do, he says to this conspiracy theorist. Stay safe. You should stay safe because there are crazy conspiracy theorists out there, and they might stalk you and your family. So in the day after the shooting, he was going to someone who has made his name by stalking the families of those who lost kids in Sandy Hook and telling him, you should really be raising some questions about this. I don't know. It might have been more than one person. And he got what he wanted, because that very same day, Hal Big went on InfoWars. They published a story. Video, second shooter reported in Florida massacre. Of course, that was not true. It was never true. I'm sure InfoWars had some sort of big public apology as a result of that. But he was so happy about the fact that there might be a second shooter there, that the mainstream media narrative around Parkland might have for an hour been wrong, turned out it was, but it might have been, that Halberg gloated in a reply that he can no longer be called a fraud. No, still a fraud, still a fraud. That's probably the nicest thing that you're actually being called. Now, what's so disgusting is that this guy Halberg, at this point, was not some unknown quantity. He had been spamming law enforcement around Sandy Hook to try to get as specific details as possible about the cleanup of the Sandy Hook shooting. He wanted to know how much blood was sopped up, how many bone fragments, how many brain fragments. He was doing all of that, specifically posting emails being sent out to tons of people, including this NRA official, with the names of individual victims in the subject line, saying that they had not actually been killed, that it was faked. In one of those cases, he talked about a particular victim and said that she had never actually died. He maintained for years that she had never died. And look, we can never connect any particular actions to any particular act of suicide. But the father of one of these people that was targeted by this conspiracy theorist recently took his own life, died by suicide. And again, we can't make any links necessarily. That's not what I'm trying to do. But you need to understand the sort of people that the NRA is communicating with in the immediate aftermath of these massacres. They're not talking to the victims. They're not trying to reassure them. They're not even talking to their activists, their members. They're going to the darkest conspiracy theorists on the internet to try to get people whipped up in a frenzy and pointed in the wrong direction. That's who they are. We act still like on the right, there's these different competing camps. And you know, there's constitutional conservatives, and there's the evangelicals, and there's the business community. At the end of the day, they all overlap. They all end up hitting, you dig just a little bit deep, you will hit InfoWars at some point now. And it is disgusting. So we know what the NRA's strategy is. We know particularly how it has been applied to individual shootings. So the next time it happens, don't be surprised when they put out a video attacking the victims or attacking people who are pushing for gun control. That is not some sort of knee-jerk reaction. That is a part of their established strategy, and you can expect to see more of it in the future. Okay, we're going to take a short break. We come back. Another guest is going to join us on the other side. When rich, powerful people find out that, shockingly, they're going to spend some time in prison, it can be a difficult thing to deal with. They're not necessarily cut out for prison. I know I wouldn't know what to do on the inside, but there are people whose job it is to get people ready for possibly a life in prison, and that is where Justin Paperny comes in, federal prison consultant, author of Lessons from Prison and Ethics in Motion. Justin, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you. I'm very curious about this because there have been a number of high-profile people who have already received big sentences recently, some connected to Donald Trump, some who might in the education scandal. Michael Avenatti might end up spending a little bit of time in prison. And so you advise people on how to prepare for that. So what sort of advice do you provide?
Well, the advice depends on where they are in the journey. Based on where the defendants are in this college cheating scandal, what I advise them is, if they've done it, I ask them on our call, what is success for you? And usually success is the shortest sentence in the most favorable environment. And of course, they hope that environment is their home, meaning they got probation or home confinement. So in order to get there, if they did it, I encourage defendants to accept responsibility, to move towards accepting a plea agreement. And therefore, they can move on with their life, let the healing begin. And also, it helps them get their highest goal, the shortest federal prison sentence. So that's where our conversations range right now. If you did it, own it. Let's move to the next phase.
So I know we definitely can't talk about any particular individuals or anything like that, but and the goal, as you point out, is to not spend time actually in prison, to make the right choices along the way that you don't end up there. But if you do, I imagine that there's quite a bit of anxiety around that, fears. It's a very different sort of environment. So if somebody is about to actually spend a year or 10 or life in prison, in that aspect, what sort of advice might you provide?
Well, for the majority of our consulting clients, the white-collar advice, they have to understand the experience is going to eventually end. They're coming home. So part of my goal is to help them find some perspective. People have endured worse. My business partner, Michael Santos, served 26 years in prison. Sean Hopwood, my other partner, served 11 years for robbing banks. He's now a professor of law at Georgetown, and they came home strong and ready. So what we help them do is, one, debunk many of the misperceptions they have about prison. They're going to get raped. They're going to get hurt. They're going to have to go into protective custody if they cooperated. Those things are all on TV. So we help them create a plan, hold them accountable, and help them focus on the toughest thing, coming home with a sullied reputation and recognizing this is harder on their family, on their children. And if they have that realization, they'll be productive in prison and 2 years won't feel like 20.
That is interesting. I certainly would like to hear more about the misconceptions, because everything that I know about prison is mostly from like Oz, I guess, which is not only a TV show, but it's not a recent one even. I'm also curious too, though, what sorts of questions do you get asked? Are there any that stand out as particularly common?
Are there going to be white supremacists in there? The answer is yes. I wrote about an experience with a white supremacist in my book, Lessons from Prison. Are the showers private? Will I have to go to the restroom in front of other people? What will my job be? Will I be scrubbing toilets and showers? Will I be ostracized because of my net worth or because I was a celebrity? How do I respond to guards if they want to speak with me? And if we had 17 more days, I can go on for another 17 days of questions they have.
So I am curious too, you talked a little bit about your partner, and I find your path very interesting. So you spent time in prison, and you decided to come out and sort of make that your career as a consultant in that area, in addition to other work that you do in writing and speaking and all of that. What made you make that choice?
I was in prison with my partner, Michael Santos, spinning out of control. I was angry at all the money I gave to lawyers, angry at how poorly I work with the government. I lied to them. Made it, worse for my victims, worse for my parents. And I was in prison wondering, what the hell is going to happen with the rest of my life? What do I do as a white-collar educated executive? What do I do? And I realized there were so many people in prison just like me, worried about what they're going to do in the future and living in regret over how they prepared for sentencing in prison. So with Michael's help, we orchestrated a plan where I began writing blogs, and then we wrote a book, and I began mastering the Bureau of Prison policies, documenting the journey, which is so key. Every day on the inside, I documented it. And within weeks of writing a blog from prison, hundreds of people were sending me letters just thanking me, providing a glimpse into this unknown world of confinement. So it started on the inside, recognizing, wow, there's a lot of things I could have done differently. And I lived in such regret. And that's why I have frequently said that Washington Post article that ran on our company, the hardest part is before you go to prison, the wondering, the waiting, what's going to become of my life? I ate poorly. I gained weight. I was in denial. I lost friendships, relationships. That's the hardest part. And frankly, I want people to do better and orchestrate a plan to emerge successfully.
And that is fascinating. And there's so many questions I want to ask you. I don't know how much time we have, but one, I guess, gets into the area of misconceptions. So I'm not particularly well off or anything like that. And it can be frustrating for me when I see very rich people, especially if they're politically connected, politicians who go down for corruption scandals, things like that. In the off chance that they actually do time, it always seems like the sort of the idea is that they're going to go to a place that is a better lifestyle than what I have on the outside. Is that accurate? How nice are the nicest lockups?
I'm frequently debunking the myth that federal prison camps are country clubs, and I have filmed and written about that before. You are absolutely separated from your family. You live in an environment around people with whom you've never shared space before. You were told what time to eat, what time to sleep, what type of job you're going to have, when you can visit, when you call home. Everything is recorded. So it makes some people makes them feel good knowing perhaps these privileged, entitled people are going to federal prison. Then they say, well, it's going to be easy for them anyway. They're going to be inside of a country club. There is nothing about it that is a country club. You are certainly separated and confined. And if you're living in the worst apartment in the worst city in America, I'd rather be there than the inside of a federal prison, especially in there's open environments. Imagine walking into a gym, you see 150 bunks with no privacy or separation. That's where you're going to be living for several years. So I want to make that very clear. There's very little about it that is a country club, other than perhaps a tennis court or two.
Justin, this is so fascinating. Thank you for joining us. I wish that we had more time, but we really do appreciate you joining us. And I have a feeling that you and your company are probably going to be pretty busy in the near future.
I'll close with, good people can make bad decisions. If they accept responsibility, they can move forward and have an even better life, as I have.
Okay, I think that's a good point to end on. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much.
We here at The Damage Report are going to take one more break, though. When we come back, the DCCC's big change to attempt to make it more difficult for primary challengers in future cycles has received some strike back from people like Ro Khanna. We're going to break down what they said after this. Last week, the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee announced that they were doing a big party policy change that would make it much more difficult for primary wins in the future. Effectively, if you're one of the many consultant companies that helps campaigns spend money, reach voters, do advertising, all of that, and you work with someone who is challenging a sitting Democratic representative, then you'd be blacklisted, and the DCCC and all of the money that they raise would no longer ever be accessible for you. Now, this was obviously heavily criticized afterward, but they are standing strong, and they think that this is still a good idea. The chair of the DCCC, Sherry Bustos, was on Morning Joe, and here's what she had to say.
We are telling vendors that we do business with, and keep in mind that the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee, we will raise somewhere around $200 million over the next couple years. That's a lot of money that we spend with different organizations that help elect Democrats. What I'm saying is, if you're in the business of helping elect Democrats, we'll do business with you. But if you're in the business of opposing Democrats who are in office or the seats that we're trying to pick up, then we probably don't want to do business with you.
First of all, one of the most obvious problems with this is that this is not going to be a policy that they hold themselves to in particular cases. So if next time around someone who's more business friendly, more centrist, wants to challenge AOC or Ilhan Omar, I have a feeling the DCCC will find some way to work with companies that are helping consult on that campaign. That's a prediction. You can check it in a couple of years. I feel pretty safe making that one at this point. The bigger issue is that this is maddeningly self-defeating. This is not just screwing over liberals or progressive voters and saying, no, you're going to be stuck with whoever we have, and we're going to try to scare you into submission so that you never actually aim for any representatives who are more reflective of your actual values or will push for the actual policies that you want. It's not just that. I expect that out of the DCCC. But this is also maddeningly self-defeating for the party itself. Again, we say this over and over. Who are the people in the party that are actually driving the conversation, who are pushing the party in the direction that is reflective of what people actually want? They love to say there's like 62 new representatives, but you only talk about 5 of them. Okay, well, we don't owe those 5 any coverage. We give it to them because it is earned, because they are reflecting our values, communicating effectively, and pushing for policies that the American people actually want. That is a good thing for the party, not a bad thing, and you should want more of that. You could have more of that, but they are going to make it as difficult as possible. Whatever power they have to exercise over this process, they will exercise to make it so that you won't have another Ayanna Pressley or another Rashida Tlaib. That all of them, maybe they can still run, but they're going to have a lot harder of a time actually communicating with voters and organizing and putting out high-quality ads. Look, that's sort of sarcastic. In the end, I think that companies will come up that will work with these teams, that will not want to work with the DCCC. I think that the DCCC will eventually be seen as a negative thing to have coordinating with your campaign. I am working to make that so as we speak. But the DCCC still has some power, and they are using it in an incredibly corrupt fashion. I just want to read one quote. Representative Ro Khanna, he said, this unprecedented grab of power is a slap in the face of Democratic voters across the nation. It's something even Rahm Emanuel would not have done and is totally tone deaf to the grassroots activists across our nation. Voters are sick of the status quo holding on to power and stifling new voices. They are sick of D.C. politicians who care more about holding on to power than a true competition of ideas. And that is a competition that is going to proceed regardless. Whatever the DCCC wants, they can try to exercise their power now, but it is only going to hasten the taking away of that power and redistributing it to people who actually reflect the will of the voters. Ro Khanna gets that. The people who have come in through primaries get that, and hopefully they will have more company in the future. Okay, thank you, everybody, for watching this episode of The Damage Report. We really appreciate it. We'll see you tomorrow morning.
Thanks for listening to the full episode of The Damage Report. Support our work, listen ad-free, access members-only bonus content, and more by subscribing to Apple Podcasts at apple.co/TYT. I'm your host, John Adirola. I'll see you soon.